Thank you. So rule number one, the definition of sexual harassment is narrower. The key words that we now have to take into account are these. Conduct must be so severe, pervasive, and objectionably offensive that it denies the person equal access to the college's education programs and activities. Rule number two, the jurisdiction of a Title IX complaint. It is now more restricted for who and where. Very briefly, the person who complains must be a current student or employee. What they're complaining about must be related to a program or activity, and it must have occurred on campus property or an event that the college controls. Rule number three, reporting. So what's new?
This Lisa, can I interrupt real quick? Somebody's asking if you could share your screen if you're having a slide or something of that nature.
I don't think I need to unless people are concerned about what I'm saying. But I will show two slides when we go through this again.
We could send something out later as well.
Oh, and I'm going to be sending out quite details. Today, I really want to be very brief with what I say so that people get this overall view.
Okay,
so rule number three is reporting. What's new, and this is crystal clear, reports must come to the Title IX coordinator. What is not so clear is a section in the regulations that says officers with authority to take action upon a report of sexual harassment. We're not sure what and who officers with authority means. Rule number four, supportive measures. What's new is that this is now the law. Before it was best practice. What the regulations say is that the support must be offered promptly to the complainant and the respondent. And whatever we do cannot be punitive or discipline or burdensome to either party at this point. So rule number five, formal complaint. So what's new with filing a complaint? With the regs, what they are now telling us is that unless the complainant submits a written signed document, there is no investigation. And the regulations have been very clear that we now have to refer to the person filing the complaint as complainant and the person who the complaint is about is the respondent. The Title IX coordinator can also fill in and sign a formal complaint on behalf of the complainant. So rule number six, informal resolutions such as mediation and restorative justice. This is new with lots of ins and outs. Three key points on this one that I want to point out today is that this is only permitted after filing a formal complaint. Both parties have to give voluntary, informed, and written consent that they want this to happen. And there needs to be a facilitator appointed to oversee this process. Rule number seven, the investigation. Once we get a formal complaint, we are obligated to investigate. We've done that in the past. But what's new about the investigation? Two key points I want to point out with this is that the role of the investigator will now change as they will be just gathering facts and putting that in a report. The other thing that is new in this process and this bit is that this report, which will be called a fact-based report, must be given to the complainant, respondent, and their advisor to review and respond within 10 days before the next steps. Rule number eight, and this is the next step. This is huge and it's complicated, and we still need to work out the ins and outs and who and how this will be managed. It's the hearing panels. Pretty much no community college has this in place. After an investigation is over, we must hold a hearing and this hearing has to be live and it has to be recorded. The hearing is run by someone that'll be called a hearing officer, who is also known as the decision maker. This is a new role. Both parties will be entitled to have an advisor present. The hearing will involve cross-examination, but only by the advisor. And the cross-examination will occur to the complainant, the respondent, witnesses, and the investigator. The decision maker, which is the hearing officer, will be responsible for determining whether the allegations are sustained. The terminology used in the regulation is the respondent, is, are they or not responsible for the allegations? Rule number 9, advisors. This is new, and you've heard me mention this name throughout this very, very brief overview of these new regulations. The advisors need to be involved in an investigation from the start. They must be available to both the complainant and the respondent, and they must be trained. And rule number 10, appeals. This isn't new, but it may change how we offer it, and it has to be offered to both parties. So what I do want to do right now is share my screen and show you 2 slides. So give me a moment as I get that set up. Okay, let me just, I want to go back one, so bear with me, sorry. Okay, so what I have done is given you 10 rules. What I have up now is what we have been doing and will be doing up until August the 14th. We get a complaint, we investigate it, the investigator makes a determination. Following that determination, the appeal can go to the Board of Trustees, and if it's a student-based complaint, then it would go to a student conduct hearing for sanctions. And at that point, of course, whatever human resources has been involved in is now taken over by student services. This is the added layers to what we now have that we have to implement after August the 14th. Yes, we get the complaint. Yes, there will be an intake. Next image is that any time during the investigation, we can have this informal mediation. Notice an investigation, and again, that has changed by what the investigator is charged to find. What we've never done in the past is provided the complainant and the respondent with the report with an opportunity to respond to it in writing if they feel that what's in the report they disagree with. Then, of course, we now have to think about where do we go from there as far as routing the determination. Did the allegations meet the requirements that we now have to meet, such as the new definition? Did it happen in the locations that we are only able to investigate for? Then it goes to the adjudication hearing panel, excuse me, who find responsibility. And then we have the appeal. So a number of new layers that we have not been familiar with that we now have to start to work with. Okay, let me go back. I'm going to stop sharing just for the moment. Just bear with me.
And we have a question. Who reviews responses from notice of investigation?
Can you just bear with me? I've just got to get out of one document so I can bring something up again. So just...
Sure.
Yeah. All right. All right, so what was the question, Alan?
The question was, who reviews responses from notice of investigation?
who reviews the responses from notice? Does the person mean the report from the investigation?
So Lisa, you said that they have to send, after the investigation, they send out the report, and there's 10 days for either to respond. So if somebody responds, is this where, does the decision maker come in here, that role, or is who's responding? What is that process? Because this is what would lead to possibly resolving before a hearing, right?
If there are questions about this fact-finding report, that would come back to the Title IX coordinator. That would come back to me. And I would look at it, and then I would see if there needs to be something else that needs to go into that. The decision maker would not see this report until all parties have had an opportunity to look at it.
Deirdre, I think it sounds like the students, the folks involved in the case, the respondents and the complainants are able to review that report before it moves forward.
Yes.
Right. No, I get that. It was just that if they have a response to it,
if they do, they have to put it in writing, and then we have to look at it. By the way, during this investigation part, the complainant respondent will also be given whatever material that is gathered. They will also have a right to see that material during the investigation up front, and they can respond to that as well. Any other questions?
Lisa, can you go over the cross-examination part again?
Okay, cross-examination. Are you talking about at the hearing?
Yes.
All right, so the guidelines we've been given have told us that at this hearing, we can have one hearing officer or we can have a panel. Folk that I've been talking to at other colleges and the training I've gone to have said that a panel is preferable because it could avoid any question about conflict of interest. It has also been recommended that the folk on this panel obviously have to be trained, but there shouldn't be students on these panels because of the seriousness nature of what's being discussed. So the panels have to be live. They have to be recorded. It is possible on the request of the complainant and the respondent that they not be in the same room, and if this was done via Zoom, then that would be okay. The only person who is allowed to cross-examine the parties is an advisor. The advisor needs to submit questions to the decision maker, and the decision maker will review the questions to see if they are suitable questions. It is also important to note that in place now, and this would come with the training, that there is what they call rape shield protection for the complainants. Do people know what rape shield means? Because if not, I'll explain that. Okay. Rape shield means that there cannot be specific questions about the complainant's sexual past or prior sexual behavior that's not relevant to the case, unless these two things are in evidence. One, that the questions and evidence about the complainant's prior sexual behavior are offered to prove that someone other than the respondent committed the conduct alleged, or if the questions and evidence concern specific incidents of the complainant's prior sexual behavior with respect to the respondent and are offered to prove consent. So they're the questions. And in talking to my colleagues about it, and we talk about how long will something like a hearing last, it could last for hours. People are talking 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours. It is truly grueling. Once the decision maker, the hearing officer, hears all the evidence, they then have to make the determination as to whether there is a violation of our policy. And at this point, we know that the decision maker can't be the Title IX coordinator and can't be the investigator. if we are looking at using folk within our own college. And the decision maker needs to understand other elements too, such as the preponderance of evidence standard and how to come to a conclusion. Once that report is written, that decision is made, then after that, the complainant and the respondent will get a copy of that report. And that report will include the conclusions from the hearing, the rationale, possible discipline sanctions for the respondent, possible remedies for the complainant, and how to file an appeal. After that is over, we then have to look at what are the appeal options. And that may be different to what we have at the moment, because at the moment the appeal is to go to the Board of Trustees. So I think, Laurie, that was your question. Does that answer it?
Yes, thank you.
And I'm sorry if you've got hearing noise in my background. Today of all days, they're doing something outside. Any other questions?
I was just going to add, Lisa, on the cross-examination, a lot of the attorneys firms that are conducting these webinars for us, mm-hmm. they're adamant that those who are doing cross-examination must be thoroughly trained in cross-examination, and that those people, as Lisa mentioned, are the advisors, and mm-hmm. those advisors have to be adequately trained as well mm-hmm. in being an advisor.
And here's what they also say, that if you do not go to the hearing, your testimony may not be used. And so the pressure will be on to be at the hearing so that you can then be cross-examined by the advisor. A lot of people are talking about advisors most likely being attorneys, but that is not in the regulations that it has to be an attorney. But that is something that the college has to provide. We are obligated to do that. And at the moment, there is no such position or role that we have. And we're not the only college in that situation.
Next question. What is the role of the panel if they are not making decisions or asking questions?
The panel will be involved in determining whether, as a group, whether the allegations can be supported. But it will be the hearing officer or the decision maker who has to write the report, but the panel will make that decision. And the panel will be ensuring that the way the hearing is held is done and done fairly for both all parties. Any questions, more comments? Nick has his hands raised.
My question is, do you know what the philosophy was for these changes? Has anyone from the department talked about that?
The philosophy, not so much, but when these new regulations were put out last year, and there were probably more close to 200,000 comments, the issue, what got the ear of Betsy DeVos was respondents believing that they were not being given due process, or that their rights were violated, and that the colleges, more likely universities than community colleges, were expelling or suspending them without going through any due process to find out what actually happened. And so there was a large outcry. There've been a lot of court cases where respondents have gone forth and argued that and won. And so that seemed to be behind part of these regulations as well.
Thank you.
Linda had a question. Would we be contemplating a standing panel?
I've been in talks with my colleagues in Region 8. I've also been talking with an organization that are our insurers, Keenan's, and I'm part of the SWAG HR committee. We're trying to talk about the ways of how we can actually hold these panels and who can we use. If we could create a pool of people who are trained that could be shared from college to college, that could be something that we could consider. I have to say up front too, I don't think that we will have too many hearings because the criteria for a Title IX complaint is so narrow that it may not end up there, but we have to be ready should that happen. If we have a pool of trained people, then we can share. For example, if we have to host a hearing and there's nobody available at SMC, if there is a pool, for example, if someone at Cerritos is available, we could pull that person in and they could be on the hearing panel. So the hearing panels can change. It doesn't have to be, as far as I know, it does not have to be the same person or the same group each time. But what is clear is that they do need to be trained with an understanding of Title IX and obviously an understanding of how these hearings have to work and how they manage that. Linda, does that answer your question? Thank you. And the other thing I'm just letting you know is I am also talking about seeing if we can arrange training that we can go to so that we can be trained. And I'm doing that through Keenan's and SWAC organization. So I will keep people up to date with that as well.
Lisa, how will we be able to use folks from other colleges? How do we get around FERPA doing that is my first question. And my second question is, has anybody from HR from your office ever been to a hearing through SJA and know what that process looks like and all the steps that we take? Because what this process seems just probably 95% similar to what we already have in place for SJA. And it would be fairly simple to create kind of parallel processes for these types of reports and then tweak the last 5%. So we have like a pool of folks we train every year. And when hearings come up, we reach out to those folks, see who's available for those panels. They know the process, the procedures and regulations related to adjudicating the hearings. So there's just a little bit of tweaking in terms of the trainings.
You know, that is, Lena, that is something that I would really like to talk to you more about, to actually really, and I haven't been to a hearing, and I know you and I spoke some time ago about getting to know more about that part of what you do. We just haven't had a chance, and now that we're in this remote environment. But I'd like to see if that's possible, that if it can be tweaked in a way. I know your panels have students on it, and I wouldn't be recommending that for Title IX. And if folk are trained, then in being trained on Title IX is the next bit. And if we already have folk who understand Title IX, and I understand from you that some of the people on your in your hearings are also involved with Title IX because of Title IX deputies, we could talk about that and explore that. I think that is something that, you know, we need to sit down and say, yes, would this fit the requirement of what the regs say? As far as using people from other colleges, the FERPA question is a good one. And in our discussions, we haven't even touched on that yet. The first comment was, how are we going to staff these hearing panels? Are there other options? And we're working on that now. And certainly the issue of FERPA will come up to see if that becomes an issue of using a pool of individuals and and getting those individuals from other campuses coming to ours. So yeah, it'll be a question that we have to answer.
I mean, you have a robust group of Title IX deputies that you could train to serve as these officers as well. Well, anyway, we can talk offline, but I'm happy to help you think through the processes. And I see Scott's comment. Yeah, it runs smoothly. There's scripts, there's chairs who run these committees. So I'm happy to share all those processes and protocols, and we can tweak the last, like I said, 5%.
And I think that would be great. And I'm glad you did mention that we do have a robust group of Title IX deputies, because this is where I think the role of the deputy would be crucial, if not as in the hearings, then maybe as an advisor, that if a complainant or respondent wanted to talk to somebody and have somebody with them, that a Title IX deputy would also have an understanding that they could provide that information. There doesn't seem to be anything in the regs that says how many advisors a complainant or respondent is entitled to. What it does say is that we have to provide one. The onus will be on the college. So that is, which is why I have the Title IX deputies here today, is that could be a really valuable role that can be played and shared, knowing that you most likely would, if you're called on once a year, I think I have about 14 Title IX deputies. I am not imagining there'd be 14 hearings. If there was one or two, and I could be wrong, but just in what we've seen in the past, I do not think there'll be a lot, but we have to be ready for it and we have to be trained. So Lena, I will take you up on your offer and yeah, let's talk offline to see how we can do this.
Yeah, my pleasure. And the next time we have an appeal hearing through SJA, it might be helpful to attend to kind of see what it looks like in person.
Yeah, I'd also think it would be helpful if Linda and Alan.
Yeah, I would love to go. I think it's great for us to understand that process over there as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to go too.
We might not overwhelm a student all at once. A couple of them, we'll split y'all up and make sure you get to see what it looks like before you have to roll the processes out.
Because how often do they happen?
We had one a couple weeks ago. We usually have 3 or 4, depending on the year or semester. But I'll keep you all posted. Yeah, it's not a time. It's only when students want to appeal either a suspension or want a hearing for readmission. And we do have a readmission hearing coming up, and they look similar. So,
keeping in mind now, students will have, and employees. Well, students will have to go through two forms of hearings. One that is the stage after the investigation is over, and then once the sanctions are in place, those hearings, if they want to appeal, employees have to go through this hearing as well. It's not just for students. And we have to work out how that looks too. And then employees would have their rights depending on what the outcome is, as far as if there are going to be discipline, then we have to take into account bargaining agreements and protocols for employees from that level as well. And at this point, you as a group are the first group that are hearing this. This has, no one else has seen this. And so we do have to talk about how do we roll this out now? How do we let the college know what's happening? I should also say that in this, we do need interim policies, and our admin regulations are probably going, not probably, are going to have to be reviewed, not just the ones that fall under HR, but if there are any, Lena, that you oversee, they may have to be looked at as well. And I know Bob Myers is working on those, hopefully furiously, because we have to have them by August the 14th.
Yeah, the ones that my office oversees have been in the committee for revisement for a little while now. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the changes are finalized yet.
I can tell you these will be interim policies. There is no way we could introduce a policy without going through participatory governance So we'll call them interim because they will be implemented over the summer, and that is before, for example, faculty come back. So that's my understanding of what we're going to do with our policies.
Nick mentioned the concept of doing mock hearings, since the hearings don't happen as often, especially on the Title IX side. So yeah, I think that's a great idea as well.
I do too, and certainly when I have more information about the training, I will certainly share that with everybody. But I do think, you know, I went to a training a year or so ago where they kind of had a mock hearing, but we were all too green as far as understanding the nuances of what these and the regulations were out then. We were speculating. So it is very nerve-wracking. It's going to be particularly difficult for the complainant to sit through a cross-examination. It'll be like a court hearing. Mm-hmm. And as a Title IX coordinator and speaking to my colleagues, we are concerned about how that part of our population is going to feel. And there is a sense that will they actually come forward and file complaints, knowing all these extra steps are going to be in place. And we don't know yet. We just, in the training that I've been to, where there are survivors of sexual assault, they're already concerned about how the impact, the trauma, the extra trauma this will have on them. And speaking of trauma, when it comes to the support part that we have to put in place, the regs are very clear as far as what can we do with the respondent before the investigation. And we can't remove the respondent if they're in the same class, even if the complainant is saying that they are stressed by this and traumatized. The only criteria they will allow is if there is some evidence of physical force. So the regs did not even take into account that side of the impact of sexual assault, only the physical part. And that was something that in the responses that I was part of, that we were arguing that that's not reasonable. Is there another question?
Yeah. I had a question. I was wondering if there's a criminal case, which is also ongoing, say if it was a rape or something, or a sexual assault that wasn't rape, but it was a sexual assault. How would that interfere, that's a bad word, how would that impact what we're doing?
All I can tell you is what we do now is that if there's a criminal investigation, and Johnny, you can jump in as well, we give that some time, but we do reach a point where we do have to do our own investigation. Sometimes the police move extremely slowly and we just can't wait till they finish. So we will do our own. The one issue would be is the cooperation of parties in our own investigation. If they are undergoing a criminal investigation, how much would they cooperate with our investigation?
So what I take away from what I read is that we currently have assisted with writing reports that we will not be able to write reports anymore because our reports would be discoverable for both sides, and they're also discoverable on the criminal side. So since there would be if there is an active criminal case, and that's only if there's an active criminal case, we can't disclose anything. So I think at that point in time, we probably shouldn't be writing any reports at all or sharing any reports that were completely out of it and staying on the criminal side the whole time. And telling our victims to go, and here's the options. And then if they want to go criminal, they go criminal. And then they have the option to do a formal complaint through Title IX. And if they go formal complaint through Title IX and do not want to go criminal, then we're completely out.
So we haven't talked about, and it's something that with the care and prevention team, we have to look at as well, as far as reporting, because any report and I'm just speculating now again, lots of ifs and buts. If someone does file a maxient report, that is not a formal complaint. So there would have to be follow-up, and that would come from me to determine whether they did want to file. If the complainant didn't want to file a formal complaint, then that's okay. But we are charged by law now to provide supportive measures, which we do now anyway. This isn't new for us, but it was always best practice. Now it's the law that we have to do something. And if we don't do something, then that could impact on the college for not following up.
Lisa, I have a question.
Yeah.
How is a complaint a formal complaint? Like, is a Title IX report that comes in to you, for example, is that considered a formal complaint? Or does the student need to fill something out?
Yes, the student needs to fill, the way I've read the regs and the way I've talked to my colleagues, the students have to fill something out. Maxient report coming in is not a formal complaint.
Okay.
Student has to write something and sign something and then has to say they want an investigation. I can do that for them. So that part of the regs I do understand. If the complainant does not want a formal investigation, as Title IX coordinator, I have a choice. I can accept that, or I can say, no, what you have told us is serious enough that may affect the safety of the college. I may proceed anyway. They are rare. I've never had to do that up to now, but we are going to be in treading new waters come August the 14th. I'm not quite sure what would happen. I'd certainly want to get legal advice before violating a complainant's request.
And is there currently a form or guidance on what the student needs to write and say and all of that?
We have a complaint form, and that hasn't proved difficult for anybody to fill in with the information that we require. And what then happens in the interview is that we then expand on some of the things they may say. We need enough to see that there is a Title IX violation. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I should also point out that if a complaint comes in and it doesn't meet the Title IX standards, we have other options that we could follow. For example, we could pursue it under our Title V regulations. That is different again. Title V regulations covers discrimination based on disability, on race, on age. That also includes sexual harassment. There's that option. There's also other options that could happen through student judicial affairs, if appropriate. So the thing with these new regulations is, because it's made it quite narrow, we have to follow that path for Title IX. It doesn't mean that we can't do something. For example, the new regulations state very clearly that if the incident occurs overseas, it cannot be Title IX. Up until right now, with our study abroad, if Denise is still on the line, I would go and present to the faculty and to students about being safe overseas. Now, according to the new regulations, Title IX only applies if you are in the United States. Having said that, if there is an incident overseas, it doesn't mean that the college can't do something anyway, but just take a different avenue to address that, because you certainly couldn't say, oh, too bad, we can't address the behavior that occurred overseas because it doesn't fall under Title IX. We can find another way to address that.
That's good.
Lisa, about the advisors that complainants and respondents receive, can they choose who they want as their advisors, or is that a pre-trained pool of folks you assign?
My understanding is that we can assign our choice, but that is so new. That's a really good question of, with this pool, can the complainant or the respondent say, no, I don't want that person? I'm not hearing that. But again, that hasn't been fleshed out. The only facts I really do know is that we have to have these available. Complainant or respondent can get their own from somewhere else, but if they request one from the college, we have to find one for them. And unless there's a conflict of interest, I think that it would be difficult for the complainant to say, no, I don't want that person. But that's a good question, and it has to be on the list of things to answer.
So like for student conduct, for example, students have the option of bringing someone of their choosing to the hearing to serve as kind of their person of support, or the person that asks all the follow-up questions, or whichever. So,
and they can do that in this hearing model as well, that they can bring their own. And if one side brings someone, we must provide someone for the other side. So if someone's bringing, we don't have to provide an attorney, but if someone does bring an attorney, let's say the complainant does or the respondent does, then we are obligated to provide an advisor for the other side as well. So in your model, Lena, do you have to provide advisors?
No.
Okay. I haven't heard of, I'm respondent and complainant are the only folk I've heard about advisors. I do not believe this applies to witnesses, and I don't believe it would apply to the investigator either.
Lisa, just when you were talking about both parties are entitled to have a party present, but cross-examination only by an advisor, so that would mean if somebody brings somebody, they can't ask questions or any of that at the end. It would only be the advisors that are allowed to do that cross-examination. So that'd be a little different, I think, than the way it is now, right? For the way Lena was describing.
Yeah. As far as I know, yes, you're right, Deirdre. It is just the advisor is the one that asks the questions. And that an advisor could be seen as different to a support person. As far as I can see, a support person can be someone who is just there to support, but the advisor has the role of cross-examining. The respondent, for example, cannot ask the complainant questions, and the complainant cannot ask the respondent questions. And those questions do need to be presented to the hearing officer, the decision maker, to see whether they are appropriate questions.
I'm sorry, did I catch that right? You have to submit questions ahead of time before you hear what folks have to say at the hearing? That doesn't quite make sense. So things come up in the course of a hearing that then you need to ask follow-up questions about that may not have been available in the paperwork or evident that you need to ask.
Right.
And that's not how hearings are, I mean, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Again, with not knowing all the nuances of the role of questioning, that is a good question. That surely and again, need to find out, do all the questions have to be submitted before they're asked, or can it just be you start to ask the questions? The concern, of course, would be to bring up something that, for example, past sexual experience without the decision maker hearing that, to say that's unless you can show me that you want to ask this question because it will prove consent. That's a really good question, and I don't have the answer yet because none of us have had the training on this to know the answer. But it is a good one. How do we handle the flow of questions as the hearing progresses?
Lisa, I'll send you the script that we use in SJA, and that might be a good jumping off point for you.
The things that I did note down and I can tell you is that if a party doesn't consent to cross-examination, their statements can't be considered in determining responsibility. It does say that they can ask relevant follow-up and credible questions. What I don't have the answer to is, does someone have to see those questions before they're asked? It seems to me that would make the process extremely long if they're waiting for the decision maker to look at the questions before they can be asked, but that I would need to confirm. And what that does say is failure to be at a hearing for cross-examination means that certain evidence may not be used.
And are there any regulations about when you're providing all of the documentation and paperwork to the decision maker or this committee for them to review before the hearing?
Yeah, there are some times. Again, I don't know for sure. I do know what times I do know is that the complainant respondent have to be given 10 days to look at the fact-finding report before the hearing. So if I'm looking at that, then I would be imagining after the investigation is over, the complainant respondent get the report, they're told that you've got 10 days because the hearing will be in 10 days, and the details of the hearing. But I don't know, again, any other set days for getting this done. If we can follow, the regs don't give us a time frame for how long we have to complete an investigation. If we follow the Title V regulations, we have 90 days.
Lisa, are we inclined as a college to do this in-house, or are we also maybe looking at, you know, contracting it out or hiring? I know, like, for example, civil service, you know, they'll contract out the hearing officers or hearing, you know, usually they'll retire judges or attorneys, and they'll hear a case. And then, and there's a ton of people out there that, you know, have the, like, attorneys. I don't know if Lyndon Allen have done this before. You know, just put on cases at civil service, or, you know, this type of cross-examination, just basically putting on the case.
That's a really good point, Scott. There's a cost involved with that. And I can tell you that we don't have money for that. And I do know that organizations out there like ATICSA are already saying, if you need somebody, ask us. But they could cost $2,000 a day, and their amounts will be extraordinary. So it's an option to pull in somebody from outside, which is why I talked about seeing what we can do by utilizing support in other colleges. Again, all the nuances of does it violate anything that we'd be concerned about? But it is a good point, Scott, that can we outsource some of this? And certainly it would help if we could.
Yeah. I will say that my experience with alternative dispute resolution through professional services is just incredibly expensive. And they tend to draw it out, maybe because of that. That's just my experience. But I'd be a little worried. I mean, all this has got to be hashed out. But if we have hearings where somebody brings an advisor who's an attorney and they start to go Rambo on us, with a cross-examination, because there has to be some follow-up questions, but panelists will have kind of a duty to ask their own follow-up questions as well. So,
I mean, those things really do need to be very clear. The more we get to understand it, the more we are going to start to ask those very specific questions. I do know that through SWAC, there is a resource document being prepared for hearing panels. I've looked at the edits, and I've given responses back, and we'll see what happens with that. And when we have that, it could provide us with a model that we could also take into account with, again, Lena, what you're doing, to see what can be tweaked. So there are organizations out there doing things. It's just nothing has been finalized, and nothing has come back to us to say, here, you know, this is what you can use. But it is happening, and people are really working really hard. But I have to say also, so much has taken over with what we've been doing lately in the past month that was not expected. And so the time that we wanted to devote to this, we've spent doing other things as well. And that's made it more difficult. And all the Title IX coordinators have said the same thing, that the other issues that have occurred on their campuses similar to ours have been a main focus. So, you know, we're, yeah.
I wanted to add along with Lisa. She's absolutely right. It's all fairly new. And Captain Carter, you're correct. A lot of there are a lot of hearing officers out there for us to tap in. I don't know that they have the expertise in the area yet. I don't think anyone has the expertise in the area yet. And I think that as we move this forward, we're going to have to figure out what works, what doesn't work. You know, perhaps having someone internal will work, or having someone from another college will work, and or not. And if it doesn't, we may need to tap into another source, since we're required to do this work, like one of those hearing officers you speak of, Captain Carter. I know exactly what you're talking about. And eventually it may be that that's all we can do based on what we face as we move this forward.
So can I make a comment real quick? It's based off of what Lena was talking about on FERPA. So it's my understanding that other schools can only get disciplinary records under FERPA without a consent, only if they are doing, the student in question is doing something at the other school, either enrolling at that other school or going to a program at that other school. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they cannot get that record. It'd be a violation of FERPA. I would think the same thing with a contractor, unless they were deemed school officials. So I don't know if we have to make them per diem employees or whatever kind of person, so that they would be school officials eligible under FERPA in order to see those records.
Yeah, FERPA is a major issue that we're going to have to contend with. We may have to sign contracts like we do with other contractors in situations like this to bring them in. So I completely agree with that. It's just so new that in the groups that Lisa and I sit in, it just hasn't been tackled because we're too busy trying to tackle the changes to put together those interim measures to kind of move this forward by the deadline.
The
other thing too, if I can just add, is that students can also sign a waiver for this, and whether that is factored into something like this, again, would be something that is the questions to ask. If the students say they're okay, they may feel that an outside person is unbiased, and that would be a good person to have. So again, it's something to explore. Okie dokie. So we're very close to the end. Are there any other questions or comments one way or the other? I know that with my colleagues, we've been swearing a lot because of what this entails, because it is so huge and daunting to know what to do next. So let me segue into next steps. What I'm going to do after today is send you a document that Atiksa did write that has an outline of these regulations. I don't think it'll answer some of your questions. If anybody is game, I will send them the OCR regulations if you have time to read. It's 2,033 pages. I will do that.
Like summer reading.
Yeah. Yeah, get that.
Took the words out of my mouth.
If anyone's
a little light reading. Oh yeah, exactly.
Trouble sleeping?
Sick. Yeah, because you know, you just can't wait to be riveted into this document. I do want to arrange training, and I will keep people informed. The training is mandatory now for those of us who are involved with Title IX, and that training will not just include, it will include hearing panel training, but also include really understanding these new concepts, understanding the new definitions, understanding other elements such as the Clery Act, how does that impact upon Title IX, the scope of investigations. And so all of us do need to be educated. There will be others. Anybody involved in a Title IX investigation, even those involved in the appeals, where it's mandatory to train them. And so that in itself will be daunting, and there will be trainings is being planned. I'll keep people up to date. We do need as a group to keep thinking about our next steps, working out who does what. Yes. I certainly hope that I have hands up with all the Title IX deputies that say, I mean, use me any way that is helpful. That would be wonderful. But I do know that everybody is busy as well. But knowing that you won't be called on daily or weekly or monthly for this, but having you there, I think would be fabulous for this college. And to keep you updated for when they're going to be, when the new policies, interim policies and admin regs can be shared. So I am finished. If there aren't any other questions, I really do appreciate your time today in sitting in on this. I hope it wasn't too overwhelming for you, that you didn't walk away saying I'm more confused than ever.
But I quit.
You can't quit, Alan. But if there is anybody who wants to talk with me offline, you can. This is being recorded, so those people who weren't able to make it, the recording will be available. So thank you, everybody, for attending. I appreciate your time this afternoon, this morning, sorry. And
Lisa, Lisa, can you and Alan and Linda stay on just 1 second?
Sure.
Thanks, Lisa.
You want to stop the recording, Lisa?
I will stop the recording. Lisa. Bye.